One of the great places to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land is to the mountain where it's reported that the Transfiguration, this event of our gospel today, actually happened. It's a beautiful sight, and it's in the northern part of Israel in Galilee, and from the top of that mountain you can look out and see all kinds of different places and hear about all the many different events in Bible history that happened, from the mountain that prophet was on to the place where that battle happened. And so you get this context of this mountain, but the context of this transfiguration. Because just as it's physically located in the midst of all these biblical events, you know, the transfiguration itself is kind of in the middle of how God deals with us, with humanity. And so the first reading attempts to start to explain that. You may be wondering, what's up with this Genesis reading and animal parts and flames and smoking pots? And like, how does that all work, you know? And so let me just unpack for you a little bit how that first reading ties in with our gospel passage. Because I think in understanding that, it'll help us know better and appreciate and give thanks for really how God extends relationship to us and what he's accomplishing for us in Jesus Christ. So our first reading from chapter 15 of the book of Genesis is that close to the beginning of Abram, this man who would have these covenants with God, this one who we call our father in faith, who later on God would kind of expand his name from Abram to Abraham. It's the same person. And so in this, you know, Abraham is asking, well, what your promises are that you're giving me, how will these be fulfilled? And so Abram is given this experience by God. He falls into this trance, this deep trance, and a darkness, kind of a shocking darkness, overcomes him. And in the midst of that, he has this vision. He sees before him this smoking fire pot and a flaming torch, you know, and which might be, you could think of in the future, you think of Israel, much later, the children of Abraham being guided by God in Exodus. What are they guided by? A column of fire the night, and then a cloud of smoke, you know, in the day. It's a little allusion to this, like this is the Lord who is there before Abram. And what does the Lord do with this? He's forming a covenant. A covenant is such an essential idea to really grasp in the Bible, and because it's in the Bible to grasp about our relationship with God. Covenant was the universal and most important form of establishing relationship, making promises between people in the ancient world. And so very fittingly, God would use that social mechanism of covenant, you know, as he's developing his relationship with Abram, with Abram's descendants, and eventually with us. And so what happens in this? Well, first of all, there's two parties in a covenant. And so on one side, we have Abram and his descendants who are kind of receiving the covenant. And then the other most important party is the Lord himself. It is he who makes the covenant at his initiative. It isn't like Abram's like, Lord, I think a covenant would be a really great way for us to relate to each other. And no, it's God who decides to do this under his initiative. And then God gives terms for this covenant of this promise that you will have these vast numbers of descendants, and to your descendants will be given this land to prosper as you live and walk in my ways. And so the terms are set by that covenant maker. And then another part of it is, in covenant making, is an acknowledgement of the penalties that will come if a covenant is broken. And so you have in the ancient world, there would sometimes be the sacrifice of animals at the making of a covenant. Basically, like, just how that oxen got it in the neck, well, so let that happen to me if I break this covenant, you know. And so the sacrifice of the animals was a sign of the need for fidelity in a covenant and how serious that is. And note that it isn't Abraham that's made to walk through the animals. Instead, it's the Lord in this vision of the smoking fire pot and the flaming torch. He passes through this. He is the one who ultimately is the faithful partner, and the faithful partner to Abram and to his descendants. And now the Lord will test and try then his partner in this covenant, testing Israel later in their faithfulness with different trials, different challenges, testing Abram himself, you know, with his son Isaac. But through all of that, it is God who again and again is shown to be faithful. He goes with them into their mess. And that's probably another key concept in the Old Testament is the unending chronicling of human messiness that God keeps entering into, from wars to family drama to slavery to idol worship and human sacrifice, all of that. God keeps showing himself faithful and guiding his covenant forward. Okay, so then our gospel, to which the Genesis reading is this companion. Let's look at that for just a few moments. In the Transfiguration, we really have a lot of elements that really tie us into this covenant making of God back in Genesis. And so you've got disciples who like Abram, you know, they kind of have this trance that they're overcome by sleep, you know, and then a bit later, darkness come upon them when a cloud comes and casts its shadow over them. So you've got kind of the same lighting setting, so to speak, in this as what you had in Genesis. And what happens? They kind of come to, and there they see Jesus, the Lord. Not like how they normally see Jesus. Instead, he appears to them in glory, this radiant presence. The other Gospels will talk about his face shining like the sun, his white clothes, as whiter than any fuller's lie could make them. Just this brilliance, in a sense that fire, that flaming torch, it's Jesus himself standing before them. And now, who is he standing with? It's not the Lord passing through these animals. Instead, Jesus is there with Moses and Elijah. Moses and Elijah are two of the greatest people in the Old Testament. Moses is the one who led Israel out of that slavery in Egypt into the Exodus. He's the one who received on Mount Sinai this new covenant with the Lord and who gave then from the Lord the Ten Commandments to Israel as the way to live faithfully in that covenant. And then you have Elijah, who generations later, when Israel is now in the land, they have kings. You know, there's this great apostasy, and Elijah is the zealous and faithful prophet who stands with the Lord and with his covenant when no one else was left. And so, yeah, they're not exactly animal parts, but there is Jesus with these two figures, these two important people that point to covenant and fidelity to that covenant, which is what those animal sacrifices were all about. And so just visually, you see a lot that ties in together with Genesis. And that there's this acknowledgement of covenant that's happening. Because Jesus comes to actually give us a new and eternal covenant. And so then what happens? We have this voice that says, "This is my chosen son." If in Genesis with Abraham the concern is about his son and his children, his descendants, now the focus has shifted incredibly to the Son of God. And he is the decisive one, the decisive child of promise. And it's amazing how Jesus, who because of the incarnation, he is truly God and truly man, in a way, he embodies the entire covenant. This meeting, this relationship between God and humanity comes together in the Son of God who takes up our nature. God and humanity united in the very divine existence of the Son. And so in a way, he stands in for both parties of this new covenant, both human and divine. And therefore, God, in his dealing with us, will at least always have one faithful covenant partner. Jesus Christ himself and his humanity. We will always have him to stand in for us, keeping that covenant always. And Jesus also, he embodies the covenant. He is also kind of the covenant offering of God. You know how there are those penalties if you break a covenant? Penalties that cascaded down upon Israel when they're unfaithful. Well, now Jesus comes, as John the Baptist says, the Lamb of God. He takes away the sins of Israel and their many failings in their covenant walk with the Lord. He takes away the sins of the world. He takes away our sins, blotting out our unfaithfulness in covenant to the Lord. He is the one through whom the mercy of God is always extended, and that happens in this great sacrifice that he gives for us. As it says in Hebrews, we have been consecrated through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. No longer animals or other things. It is the Son of God himself in his body who offers everything to make sure this covenant always lasts. And then we become members of that covenant. We become, in a sense, those descendants, those co-heirs with Jesus, if we are in relationship, graced relationship with him. And then the last thing, the last tie-in, is we have God the Father saying, that voice saying to those disciples, this is my chosen Son, listen to him. When God made his covenant with Abram, later on with Moses and with David, these covenants, binding people, bringing them to himself in union, it is God who announces the terms of the covenant. And now God is saying, listen to him, Jesus. He's the one who will give the terms of this new covenant. You know, really, it's another way of saying that Jesus, you know, he has divinity. It's only God can set the terms of a covenant with him. And that's really what the Gospels are all about. What is this new covenant that's being established for us? And how to live that, how to enter into it. And so this whole transfiguration event, you know, is to help the disciples see that. And Jesus, in talking about the terms of this new covenant, he has some really hard things for them to hear. Right before this event, Jesus says this, the Son of Man must suffer greatly and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And then it gets maybe a little worse for the disciples, for their perspective. He says then, and if anyone wishes to come after me, that is, be in this relationship with me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. You know, those are some of the terms of the covenant. It's what it's really all about. And so we see that the transfiguration is both this singular kind of mystical moment, but it's also placed within what God has done before, his covenant dealings with humanity. So what to make of this for ourselves? And let me give you two main points about that. The first is, our relationship, you know, my relationship with God, it's defined by the terms that he establishes. God defines how we relate to him. He is God and we are not. He's not just some accessory that I can add into my life along with hitting the gym and, you know, doing this and that. You know, God defines how we can relate to him because he is God and we are not. And what God has chosen is this form of covenant in his dealings with humanity. What does that mean? It means God pursues relationship with us. It's such an incredible thing, amazing. He wants us to be in partnership with him. It's like he says, I want a covenant with you. It's kind of like saying, let's get married. You know, let's have this deep relationship of family and life. How incredible that is. And that requires, though, on our part, real commitment, obedience, trust, fidelity. growing in love for God. You know, and the beautiful thing is that God helps us to do that. He helps us even fulfill our side of the covenant. Jesus is there to make that possible. As it says at the beginning of the Gospel of John, the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And then on God's part in this covenant that he's established, you know, he demands fidelity. Well, he has shown his fidelity to us first and in the most remarkable way in his Son, Jesus Christ, going all the way to the cross, freeing us from our sin that alienates us from God so we can enter into covenant relationship with him. You know, taking away our failings and all that blocks us from relationship with God. And so the cross, the crucifix, you know, always reminds us of God's fidelity, the great extent that he goes to pursue us, to draw us into life, into relationship with him. I know some people, you know, are like, well, I don't know, Catholics with their crucifix, you know, why do you still have the body on there? And but it's missing the point of what that means that Jesus is on the cross. And to them, I simply say, I believe in an empty tomb, not an empty cross. Some reject what God has revealed and what he requires of us. To them, it seems like, you know, covenant and the obligations and walking, it seems just, you know, it's a bossy church, you know, and they reject the messiness of this God working in history and with our human failings and you know, God becoming incarnate and walking among us in the blood. And it just, you know, they just want a more tidy, mystical kind of God, right? But, you know, that's not how our Lord has chosen to work. You know, and so people will say, you know, oh, well, I'm spiritual, but not religious. And this one Catholic writer, Peter Kreeft, I think makes an incredible observation. He's like, you know, I'm spiritual, but not religious. You know, that's a perfect motto for Satan. He's indeed is spiritual, and he certainly is not religious. It's not where we want to be. It's not what God accepts and offers to us. So that's point one. Relationship with God is defined by the terms that he has established. He is God and we are not. And then the second point that we can draw from the Transfiguration, among many, is to understand and accept that the glory and the cross go together. For the inner disciples, the Peter and John and James, you know, they're invited up the mountain to go to pray with the Lord. And they're given this great gift of witnessing the Transfiguration, you know, to see this glory of Christ, the glory that he always has, but so often veils, to be able to do his work and mission in the world. They're given this. They're given it as a reassurance for later on when they would face the horrible shock of the cross, for later on when they would again be praying with him and seeing him sweating blood in his agony, when instead of his glorified face more radiant than the sun, they would see his face spat upon, and instead of the brilliant white clothes, you'd see him be stripped of his clothes. And so the Transfiguration is meant to help them endure the cross and understand the glory that awaits them. You know, at the end of the same Gospel of Luke, at the very end, you have these two disciples. They're upset and confused about the cross and what happened. And Jesus, our risen Lord, meets them along the way, again veiled, you know, to be able to interact with them. And, you know, and they lament, you know, we had thought Jesus would be the one, you know, and then Jesus just kind of like drops the boom on him. And he says, oh, how foolish you are. How slow of heart to believe all that the prophets spoke. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and so enter into his glory? Necessary. Jesus knew that he would have to undergo these things to make this new covenant possible. There's a deeper divine wisdom at work than what the elders and the scribes could see, that Pilate could see, that indeed for a while even the apostles could see, this deep mystery of the cross that brings about life and glory. This wisdom of God that the cross actually leads to life and glorious transformation. St. Paul, marveling about it later on and how the world doesn't get it, would say, the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. And so how important for us, brothers and sisters, to know the Scriptures, to understand this deeper wisdom of God that He wishes to share with us. And so the Transfiguration, I think, helps us see that glory and cross go together. And this display of glory in the Transfiguration is meant to help us stay on track when carrying our own cross, when following out the terms of the covenant Jesus has made with us, especially when faithfulness to God's covenant makes that cross all the more demanding. Christ transfigured is a promise that, yes, here is the cross, but I am still the Lord, and I'm with you. And as St. Paul said in our second reading, we can hope because He will change our lowly bodies to conform with His glorified body. And so therefore, I dare to repeat also other words out of that reading from St. Paul. My brothers and sisters, whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm in the Lord.